Well, I had a couple things that I bumped into this week that I'll share with you, and they all come framed from great sources of literature and insight. One was a magazine rack at Walmart or Walgreens. The other was the radio, and then the other was a television show. And I continued to think about two things. One, the quote that I read at the beginning of the Easter Vigil from Albert Einstein about mystery. And it was so profound that at least when I first saw it, I was thinking it was some great religious mind, only to come out that it was a great mathematical mind. And they basically came to the same place in terms of mystery. And then mystery and mercy, those two things. But what I came upon is listening to the radio and reading the newspaper and found out that Mother Angelica, who was the founder of the EWTN network, started it in a garage. A poor Claire nun died at the age of about 92. Then the other was walking through Walgreens and was fairly amazed to see there was this magazine in the magazine rack that said Jesus across the top, and it was this big glossy, it almost looked like a Life or a Look magazine, that was Jesus, and right next to it was Elvis. I'm thinking, isn't it interesting in our culture, sort of this juxtaposition of faith and life, and what does it mean? And then the third thing was I'm watching this show, and they're talking about near-death experiences, and people, you know, even back in terms of, I think it was Plato, had written about a man who was a soldier and was killed in battle and went through this tunnel and saw this light and all these loved ones and yada yada and all these people talking about this experience of light. And then I'm thinking, well, this is an interesting show, except their main conclusion was this all happened because we're the offspring of aliens. I'm thinking, we got Jesus, we got all, you know, we got this nun that started this television network in a garage, and we got Jesus and Elvis on the rack, and we got this, you know, television show saying that the reason we have near-death experiences is that it's inborn in us because we're from aliens. And I'm thinking, we really try to understand mystery, don't we? I mean, we really try to wrap our heads around it, and we'll come up with sort of any crap that sort of makes sense. And here we're doing this whole Easter vigil and faith and thinking about it. And so I got all these things rattling around in my brain. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, you guys are in a lot of trouble because, again, I come and sort of inflict this on you. But, you know, go back to something, at least for me, is a bit grounding. And that's the scripture. And you know, we have this first reading, and it's the experience of the early community right after the resurrection. And they're in Solomon's portico. Now I start thinking, what exactly is Solomon's portico? And the word in Greek, portico, is basically porch. And the temple in Jerusalem, it was a square, about 600 feet, about 2 football fields square. And on the east side, there was a porch that tradition taught was part of Solomon's original temple. Now, in 587 BC, the Jews were scattered to Babylon, the Babylonian exile. They tore down the temple except for that porch. Then when they rebuilt it, that porch was a part of it. So if you think Solomon's portico, basically these guys are on the front porch of the temple. It was on the east wall, 200 yards wide. It's a big building. You would go in through that gate and then onto this porch and then into the court of the women. Because you see, ladies, you weren't allowed to worship with the men. You had to be kind of out in the yard. You went through the porch to get to where you guys got to pray. And then the men got a little bit closer, okay? So you got this huge thing. Now today, or in the year 70 AD, they came in and they tore down the Romans after about 3 or 4 years of civil war, tore down the temple, just burned it down, tore it down. There's only one piece of the temple left of that 200-yard square building, and that's called the West Wall. If you ever see pictures of Jerusalem and you got all these Hasidic Jews in hats all going like this and they're putting the little thing, that's the West Wall, the Wailing Wall. That's all that's left of the original temple. This Porch of Solomon was on the other side. I'm bringing that up for a purpose. Believe me, I'll get there in a minute. Then let's look at the gospel. We got this guy mentioned in the gospel, Thomas. We have dubbed him Doubting Thomas. Now, we don't know a whole lot about him, at least from the gospels. The three gospels, the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all mention him. You come to the Gospel of John, he's got a little more mention. He's the one that says, when Jesus tells them, I got to go back to Jerusalem, Thomas is the one that says, let us go with him so we can die with him. Thomas speaks up at the Last Supper. And then Thomas has this role here where he's a bit of a cynic. It's, you know, when you think of a skeptic and a cynic, a skeptic basically says, no, this is impossible, it'll never happen. Thomas is a little bit more cynical than skeptical. A cynic or a skeptic, well, I've just messed that up. Anyway, Thomas is not saying, I don't believe that it happened. It's just more, I doubt it. You know, I got to see it. I got to see it to believe it. And I can certainly appreciate that. A footnote, you know, Jesus really had to get his HR department a little bit more in line. He started out with 12, ended up with 11, and he had, you know, this doubter, this denier, and this betrayer in there. You know, it's not really a big statement for church growth or the ability to judge character, right? I mean, if we try to be perfect in our lives, at least we can take some comfort in that. That's a bit of a side diversion. But here you got Thomas. Now, there's an apocryphal bit of information. There's the Acts of St. Thomas. This is written probably 170 years later by a group of folks. They're called Gnostics, they figure. It never made it into the final cut of the scripture. But in this Gospel of Thomas is where we learn that Thomas, theoretically, according to this, was sent as the disciple or the apostle to India. Now, in this story, what happens is that the 12 are dealing out who goes where. And Thomas draws the short straw and has to go to India. And he says, no, this is a bad idea. I don't want to do it. I'm too sickly to go to India. So, in this gospel, or the Acts of St. Thomas, as it is written, Jesus shows up in a miraculous vision and sells Thomas as a slave to an Indian merchant. That's how Thomas ends up going to India, because he's sold as a carpenter. Well, this amazing story in this Acts of Thomas never made the final cut because the Gnostics, gnosis in Greek means knowledge. The heresy of the Gnostics was, well, you have to have this special knowledge. To be a Christian, you have to have special knowledge. And it didn't really work for the early church. Here's why I'm talking about the context of Jesus and Elvis next to one another, the history of the Porch of Solomon, and a little bit about the person of St. Thomas. Here's the question I want to ask you in that context. How does God desire to save your soul? How does God desire to save your soul? We have a cultural and historical context that we live within today. Elvis and Jesus right next to one another. A poor Claire nun starting a TV station. television that says that we came from aliens. That is our historical context. The temple existed with a porch that was traced back to King Solomon. The early Christian community met on that porch and taught on that porch. Jesus came into a historical context. He was born a blue-collar, poor working guy in a poor family, in a poor country. And yet, for some reason, we mark time by this guy's birth and what he did. Not by Muhammad, not by Buddha, not by, but Jesus Christ. This point in time changed everything. And it shouldn't have. If it were merely a cultural reality, it shouldn't have. How does God desire to save my soul and your soul? Came into the life of St. Thomas, what we know. I don't blame him about being a little bit of a skeptic. How is this going to happen? What do you mean he's here? Let me touch. He was one of the ones that was a fisherman, by the way. 7 of the 12, we think, were fishermen. Thomas was one of them. How does God desire to save our soul? By coming into our historical reality, our life where we are. Whether we were the early Christian community gathered on a porch, whether we're the Apostle Thomas trying to deal with his life and the rest, or whether we're Elvis or Mother Teresa or whoever we are in our culture. But how does God desire to save your soul? Look at your life. Where have you been? What trials and troubles and tribulations have you been through and are you in right now? Because that is the historical context, your story, where God is going to insert Jesus for the desire of saving your soul. Saving my soul. And everything in your life has meaning. Yesterday was a hard day in our house. Those of you that are animal lovers will understand. Those of you that are not will think I'm crazy. But my beautiful Labrador Retriever died. 14 and a half years he was my best friend. I said to Janelle, we got to take him. We got to take him to the vet. Got to put him down. She said, I can't be the hand of death. I said, oh good, what does that make me? But we had to do it. I walked in. Lady handed me a box of tissues. It's off to the races after that. But even in that event, as a person of faith, believe it or not, Jesus is in that event for the purpose of saving my soul. Whatever it is, nothing happens in my life by chance or in your life. Because when Jesus came into the world, we marked time by that. There's the old poem, no army that ever lived, no king that ever lived, no kingdom, not Adolf Hitler, not Alexander the Great, not any of these folks ever had the impact on the world that this one carpenter did, because he was the route and the historical context in that context to save our souls. God desires to save our soul. He saved the soul of the world, and we instinctively know that because we mark time by when it happened. And he came into that context to save the soul of the world. Now, how does God come into your life? How does God desire to save your soul? Often, our experience of faith is an intellectual ascent. And we got to see it in terms of marking the time, the point in time in our life, because everything else needs to revolve around it, because it's what gives meaning and focus to what we do. And fortunately, that meaning and focus is all wrapped in the context of mercy. Divine Mercy Sunday. He blessed our door, the church, so that when we came through that door, we can experience mercy. It's reported that St. Francis, at a moment of prayer, said to God, "Why'd you pick me to do this?" And the Lord in prayer answered St. Francis and said, "I scoured the earth looking for the person who could most represent and share my mercy." If you remember the reading from the Gospel at the Easter Vigil, where it said that, you know, the disciples and Jesus had left the site of the Last Supper, and they were on the way to the Mount of Olives. I guess that was probably be the Holy Thursday reading. But they're on the way to the Mount of Olives, and they were singing a hymn. If you remember that, they were singing a hymn as they went to the Mount of Olives, to the Garden of Gethsemane. The hymn that they were singing is the last hymn in the Seder Supper. And that hymn is Psalm 136 that goes through the salvation history of God intervening in the life of the community of Israel. And the line, the refrain is, "For his mercy endures forever." God's mercy will endure forever in your life, because that is the way he desires to save your soul. You are not alone. Whatever you are struggling with in this present context, whether it is sickness, hospitalization, struggles in the family, struggles with a job, maybe things are going well. It is in that historical context for you and for me in our life that God desires our salvation, save our soul, to dispense mercy so that we may be merciful then and serve others. And that's really good news. May the Lord save your soul through the presence of mercy in the context of your life, not distinct or separate from what you are experiencing today, but in fact in the midst of it, as he was for Thomas, for the early church, for Mother Angelica, for Alvis, for me, and for you.